Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Josh Brown, you took flight this week.
I certainly did. I was up in the sky, up in the aeroplane, looking at the world below, finally understanding the ending of Mad Men, which hopefully some people get. I was like Danny DeVito just going like, I get it now. I understand why people love this.
Being up and amongst the clouds. I should say this is the Entitled Banter podcast, the EBP, the UBP.
The UBP.
I'm Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
Fresh from a little mish to Ireland to Dublin. We'll talk more about it on the Wind-Up podcast. But everyone congratulating you for finally taking your first flight, mate.
Oh, yeah, they were. Oh, man, that's been lovely. I don't know if there's been any in the questions this week because it's been... I've not actually checked them this week, which is rare. Normally, I have a sneaky little look over them. But yeah, it's been really lovely, man. I couldn't believe the response. People are so nice.
Yeah.
I made a tweet yesterday just kind of trying to thank everyone because I tweeted about getting on the plane for the first time when I got to the hotel in Dublin and then sort of just didn't check it for a while. And, you know, I expected some nice response because people are nice, but I got back and I was just completely flawed and everyone has been... incredibly lovely, and I've not been able to reply to everyone, but it's been amazing. And everyone who sent in recommendations, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Checked out as many of those as I possibly could. A lot of them were absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'll bore you all about that trip on the wind up on Monday. That's a threat and a promise.
Yeah, as well it should be. We will we'll check back in on JB's continued global travels.
I will say though, man, you know, we talk about this all the time, like. And I'll repeat this line almost certainly on the wind-up, but I'm a pub boyfriend living in a museum girlfriend's world, so I...
Is that a thing? Is that a song? Is that a Green Day song?
It's maybe that'll be the title of my first album, perhaps. But what I mean by that is I'm knackered.
Right.
I've been on holiday, and I need a holiday from the holiday. You know, my idea of a holiday is going somewhere and doing nothing for 3 days.
No.
I like a little look around. I like a little museum. But my girlfriend, she's big on that stuff. So it was mostly a lot of walking, a lot of looking, a lot of activities. And I could have just sat in the pub for 3 days.
No, man.
So I've come back tireder than ever. And I'm looking forward to this weekend.
You're looking forward to getting back in the pub?
Yeah. Just to get back in my bed. I just want a little sleep. No. It was absolutely lovely, though. Sometimes those are the best holidays where you think, I got a lot accomplished.
You want a nice mix of stuff. I share the whole, like, okay, we should do everything vibe when you touch down somewhere. But every now and then you do just want to take a minute to actually recharge again.
I need to ask you this more in depth on Monday's podcast on the wind-up, but I am someone who doesn't even research where they're going. Like, I'll decide on my holiday when I'm in the hotel. Like, I didn't look at anything about Dublin or Ireland in general before I was literally in it. You know, I was in the hotel, and then I went through all those recommendations, and I thought, oh, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do that. I'm a wanderer, man.
He is a wandering man. Is that not taking up more of your travel, your holiday time, though? You could have been doing that on the plane. You could have been doing that beforehand. You can hit the ground running.
You know what? Let's circle back to this on Monday, where we can take up probably the first 20 minutes of that podcast for this discussion.
Let's touch base.
I mean, I'm interested in what other people do, because I think people might find that mad, and my girlfriend is, again, like, very much like, I want to go here, I want to go there, and I arrive and I'm like, what's that?
No, I've had too many, I've had too many holidays where I haven't, well, not too many, but I've had a couple of holidays where I didn't plan at all, and they were horrible, because it's like, I mean, also, I think it depends where you're going. Like, if it's something more, when I went to Japan, me and my wife planned every inch of that thing out, and we literally ended up walking, we tracked it on her step tracker, we did about 11 miles a day of walking.
Yeah.
And did everything. I don't want to regret the time. It takes so long to get somewhere that I want to make sure I'm maximizing the time. But also, you don't want it to be some militarized, go here, do this, do exactly this for this long. Like, I think there's a balance, but I wouldn't go in unprepared.
I do get it with Japan because I feel like, you know, that's obviously, you know, it's a long ass flight. It is a huge commitment in terms of both time and money. So you would want, it's like, it's not once in a lifetime. You could do it again, but it feels like a big, momentous trip to make. So yeah, I think if I went to Japan, for instance, I'd want that.
Right.
I'd want the itinerary locked in and laminated. I was going to say, like, even on that flight,
it's definitely a mix. Like, yeah, well, I'll plan everything, but like certain places, you kind of know you can wing it a bit. But I knew I didn't want to waste a single minute of being in Japan versus like when I was in Amsterdam, like last year, I was like, well, we had some stuff we were going to do, but then there's bits in between where it's like, let's just kill a few hours. Oh, let's go rent a boat. There's a boat service thing around the corner. I like a mix, but like I do like a general idea of at least what direction I'm going. I literally video game it where I'll put a marker on a map and then just get there however you want. And if you stumble into a cafe or a hiring thing or whatever it is, or some museum or something, do that on the way. But at least you're going towards a destination.
No, I definitely do that. I love that analogy there. Yeah, it's like putting your custom map marker down literally, and just seeing what icons pop up on the way. What do you bump into? What pubs do you find? What cafes do you find? Uh-huh. What restaurants do you find?
Witcher 3, my friend.
Witcher 3, yeah, man. Did that on the last day. I love gamifying it. Yeah, man. Way.
It helps with like map reading as well. Genuinely, like growing up playing GTA so much, like when I finally started having to like drive, or like, I remember my dad trying to get me to use paper maps, and I was like, I love my dad, but I'm not like bothered about doing that. But getting used to GPSs, map tracking, things like that, I was like, this is fundamentally open world game design in real life.
Hell yeah!
But still, I tell you what. One other thing I wanted to get to before we get to everybody's questions is just literally a RIP, rest in peace to Akira Toriyama. I just want to shout that dude out. Like, obviously, creator of Dragon Ball, co-creator of Dragon Quest, help with Chrono Trigger, lots of hidden gem stuff out there like Blue Dragon as well. Just one of the most, hands down, one of the most influential people in entertainment history or art history. Like, just an unbelievable talent. Yeah, everyone, man, has some association with something Toriyama put out, and most of that'll be Dragon Ball. But like, if you just want to thank him for Dragon Ball, like, that's a hell of a cultural force.
Absolutely. I mean, I am not as familiar with his work as you are, I think, outside of Dragon Ball. You know, I was obsessed with Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z.
Same.
When I was younger, I still keep up with it now to a certain degree. Like, you know how you, I don't know if you have this, but some things you leave behind in childhood and some things you take with you, and you might not be actively engaging with them in the same way, but like, you remember them fondly they're still kind of part of your identity in a way. That's definitely Dragon Ball for me, where I'm still like very nostalgic for it. I will play the games when they come out. You know, I even watched Dragon Ball Superhero, I think.
Oh, the new movie. Newest movie.
When I was off work last year. It's one of those where it's like, yeah, it's got that cultural impact, obviously, across the board, but definitely for me personally, man, like, wow. Like, like you said, what a legacy to leave behind. What a body of work. What an impact on pretty much probably everyone who's listening to this's lives at some point.
Literally, like, you've got the general, obviously, the audience response, like the general cultural response. I look at the likes of Dragon Ball Z especially, as being fundamental to opening Western minds to Eastern entertainment. Like, you put it, or I put it, alongside the Pokemons, the Final Fantasies. I mean, Dragon Quest was right alongside Final Fantasy, but Final Fantasy VII blew up so much more in the West versus, you know, Final Fantasy VI beforehand, or the earlier Dragon Quests or whatever. But like, it's all fundamental to giving people more experience of different art forms that they might love. And I just think there's something about Toriyama's artwork that was just so comforting and just so immediately escapist. Like, sometimes people, like, in certain, like, you know, entertainment fields pass away, and it's like, oh my God, that's such a loss. Mm-hmm. Like, anyone passing away is a loss, but certain talents, certain, you know, influences, it's like, oh my, we don't get any more Toriyama work. That sucks. Like,
yeah, man.
Oh my God.
I was, I was briefly looking through like the responses on social media this morning from like some of my own followers and stuff, and I thought it was like incredible, like the range of people who were reacting to it, because it's not like just nerds or anime fans or gamers that are reacting to it. Like, it was like sports pundits. It was like
the Chinese government did an official statement.
Official governments, you know what I mean? It was people from all walks of life with all different like interests. I thought that was really fascinating. You've got writers, you've got authors, you've got directors, screenwriters, you've got laborers, you know, everyone like just who has at least some kind of passing association with his work. Like, that is a reach. That is, like, again, I don't know too much about the guy personally or his other work, but that is a crazy amount of reach and
yeah.
What would you even describe it as? Not familiarity, exposure is the word yeah, I'm
yeah.
looking for.
Just yeah, even people like sports athletes citing Goku as like an influence. Like yeah. like he's like a different version of like a Rocky training montage kind of thing, and all the different Goku montages that we had. But yeah, like huge respect to Akira Toriyama. I can only recommend checking out more Dragon Ball. Like watch Dragon Ball. I did a tweet for it. I was like, check out Dragon Ball Z, you know, dig out a Dragon Quest, go play Chrono Trigger finally, things like that. Like just yeah, dude's phenomenal.
We
yeah.
talk sometimes. I really want to get to the questions. Mm. I mean, I this is why I tried to delay the island chat to the wind up because I wanted to get to the questions, but now I just want to talk about Dragon Ball. We always talk about, don't we, like we go through Dragon Ball phases.
Oh yeah, man.
And I know Adam Nicholas definitely has that as well, where you know, you just get a couple months a year where you think, I could go for some Dragon Ball in all of its forms. Let me jump into that world for a bit. Yeah, and that's man. So cool.
I've got I loved it. Was like, because we spoke about holidays before, but I remember when I first went to Paris, there's a, I don't know the name of the specific street, but there is a street in like sort of central Paris that was known as being this like nerdy street, and I had loads of really cool figure shops and game shops and retro shops and everything, and I remember just getting lost in those, looking at all these Dragon Quest and Dragon Ball figures and everything and being like, man, I love this.
Yeah, man.
And it kind of reignited it because yeah, it was there from childhood, but like again, there's something about the way that Toriyama would do characters and figures and motion and like fight scenes and everything that is just so cool, and it's so foundational that it's everywhere, and so many people took influence from it, but you can't knock that influence. Like, no. It's everywhere.
And I saw a good post this morning where someone said, no one drew Fitz better. Like, the amount of iconic looks, not just in terms of, you know, Goku's outfit. I thought
you meant, like, anger, like, I'm having a fit.
Oh,
like,
no,
Dragon
no,
Ball
no.
characters are always like, ah!
That is true. They do that. I'm about, like, clothes,
the
you know?
Drip.
I mean, even outside of the Saiyan armor, for instance, or Goku's attire, like, I saw a post that was highlighting Vegeta's iconic pink Batman yes! shirt, which is the best shirt in the entire world.
Yeah, man.
Piccolo's cap and was it cap and like t-shirt combo? Incredible stuff.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like the small things that like when you look into like different quotes that Toriyama's done about, like, I didn't expect any of this to go this big. Like, I'm just a quirky little dude, and I was just trying to make something that would be fun or whatever. And then seeing even the smallest things become iconic just due to that level of exposure. But yeah, we'll do. Like, I didn't even say at the start, but in Title Battle Podcast, we always get through as many people's questions, talking points, etc. as possible. One from Brandon Bressman, who says, 2024 has been an incredible year for gaming so far, but after the Elden Ring DLC, there doesn't seem to be much else. Do you guys think we will get more big hits late in the year, or is this basically it in terms of big releases for 2024?
You know what? It really is a frustrating time to be covering the industry, because Brandon's absolutely right. Like, in terms of the games that have come out this year, it's incredible, right?
And 2023, just, my friend.
Well, some would say it.
I would
some
say.
Some people on this podcast may say that.
Yep.
But at the same time, you've got, like, all of these layoffs happening. And my brain can't even, like, you know, meld those two things together, because how can we be living through a year where we've had all of these top releases where the industry as a business seems to be in complete disarray? I have no idea, but yeah, there are so many great games still to come that I'm looking forward to. Rise of the Ronin, Dragon's Dogma 2, and Alone in the Dark that are just this month, Stellar Blade next month. And then, like Brandon says, you know, we've got Elden Ring DLC in July. Or is it June?
Either June or July. Yeah.
June or July. And I do think after that, there are quite a few, I'd say, that are titles that are in production that don't have dates that are still to come. Like Assassin's Creed Red, I think, is this year. And there are a good few others. I was checking the Wikipedia the other day, actually, for just to see what was out. And there are a couple that don't have dates, and I do think we'll get a few surprises. Though I do think the likes of Sony and will probably, you know, kind of sit this year out. I can't imagine a big sequel coming from them or anything.
No, unless they want to, like, go, you know, they want to shadow drop something like Ghost of Tsushima 2. Like, there are things that have been in production for a while. It's just that obviously so much was hampered by the pandemic. I think for big releases, like Indiana Jones, I think, is this year.
Yeah, Avowed as well.
Avowed, like, you've got, yeah, there are, like, notable titles. I think in terms of, like, entire industry head turners, there's nothing on the level of Elden Ring kind of thing. It depends how big you want to go. But also, like, I think the phases of the industry, like, you had so many projects that were in the works during the pandemic. Then there was that whole, like, can we actually get these things over the finish line after they were delayed so much? 2022 was almost a gap year in itself, as studios figured out what the hell they were doing. I remember Game of the Year being It Takes Two. Yeah. And that game is very solid, but I wouldn't have said it was Game of the Year. But still, like, it's that whole thing of, like, we recovered from that, and then you have so many string pullers at the top going, like, okay, we need to maximize the amount of new numbers we have, hence the push towards live services, and then reacting to that, and then things being cancelled and layoffs and everything else. The industry is just, like, this weird mutated thing lumbering between different goals at the minute,
yeah,
and I don't think it knows... I mean, it can't know overall what it wants because it's not a sentient overall thing, but I feel like there are a lot of trends influencing it at the minute, and you're seeing it in real time as an entire industry struggles to respond.
This might sound like a stupid comment, but I agree this year in terms of the games has been incredible, so much to play, but it almost feels like we're still in 2023, and what I mean by that is, like, most of the great games that have come out at the start of this year were initially slated for last year. They were in that release calendar, and they got delayed at the last minute or whatever. Alone in the Dark got delayed. There were small examples. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth was supposed to come out last year.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Which is crazy, right, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. Suicide Squad, of course, was supposed to be last year. Mm-hmm. Skull and Bones was supposed to be 2018. So that was definitely a little bit overdue. But it feels like a lot of those games, some of them self-admitted, were delayed to just get away from the insane release calendar of last year.
That's a really good point.
It makes me intrigued about, what does the next year starting from June, July look like? Because it's kind of like the last, not dregs, but I can't think of another term for them, like the last sort of squeeze of the... Of the gaming tube and getting the last remnants out, which have been really good.
That's a really good point. That whole idea of, like, things that were scheduled for last year finally coming out this year. If you think of it in terms of the phases of production, then you had a whole bunch of games that were in production that were getting finished off during the pandemic. Maybe they were greenlit during the pandemic and are now coming out, depending on what those titles are. But, like, we're going into that phase of it's emblematic of them not knowing what's next. And, like, the live service push was a thing, but all of them have failed apart from the likes of Helldivers 2 or whatever. More of those bets have failed and have worked.
Yeah,
so I think it is going to be a bit more of a foot off the gas kind of year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know as much, how you feel about this, but I genuinely feel that after July, it is going, for me anyway, that's when the second half of the generation starts. Like,
right,
the first half from 2020 to mid-2024, like, that, to me, I think there's going to be a definitive end point. And then what we see after June and July is going to be what defines the latter half of this console cycle. You know, I think things like Assassin's Creed Red coming out alongside Assassin's Creed Infinity will help kickstart that, because that's the brand new take on Assassin's Creed that we're going to be analyzing and playing for the next few years. We've finally got a good few Xbox releases that are coming at the end of the year. Indiana Jones and Avowed that we've been talking about for years. It really feels like we're getting into a nice swing of things with Xbox in terms of their big projects and their releases. So yeah, I think, like, it's going to be strange that it happens halfway through a year, but a definite cutoff point in the start of, like, something new.
And when you got Sony saying that we don't have any big releases until next March, you've got the next Nintendo system in theory being pushed for a year, unless that ends up getting revealed later this year. But in theory, it won't be out until next year. That's a really good point as well. Like, yeah, like, I think it will be a split. Like, I mean, you've got, to me, the live service bet needs to fail, and then we can get back to actually just making video games again and not just making services that drain you of money. But that's definitely the intent, the amount of live service titles that are in production, especially over on the Sony side, in a different reality, they would be leading the charge. Whereas I feel like they're just on the tail end. Like, no one was expecting Helldivers 2 to work.
No.
And they need to get all those projects out there and see which ones actually, you know, fly or die.
I think, you know, this time next year, we're going to be in a really different place, because we're most likely going to have the pro consoles out for the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X.
That's later this year for the PS5.
Yeah, exactly, man. We're probably going to have the Switch 2 either out or about to release, and we're probably going to have a bunch of things announced at the end of the year, because Sony's calendar, like you were saying there, is kind of empty. I'm sure they will start announcing things like Ghost of Tsushima 2 or what have you, maybe Naughty Dog's next IP, and Xbox, like I said, you know, they're finally releasing the games they've been talking about for a while. So I'm kind of excited in that regard, because whilst we might have, you know, a couple of months of a quiet period where I finally get to go through my backlog, I feel like things will pick up quite sharpishly towards the end of the year in terms of announcements, and then next year in terms of releases. I mean, we got GTA 6 next year, man.
That's the thing. Everything's going to get out the way of GTA 6. Like, yeah. 2025 will be GTA 6. That's the thing. They know everyone's going to be buying, and if everyone's already struggling to afford things anyway, I actually think, I don't agree with you on that. I think next year will be empty, mainly because all the chatter coming out of GDC, the Game Developers Conference, is that even mid-tier games are struggling to be signed. So I think you'll get whatever's in production now, but on the Sony side, that's live service. On the Nintendo side, hopefully it's the likes of Metroid Prime 4 or something for the new system. And then on Xbox, it's like the Indiana Joneses or whatever. But I think everybody else gets out the way. One, because no one knows what the industry is doing until next year. And two, because GTA 6 is right there. And that's the one thing they know is coming. So right. It's like you might as well wait even more and sign things later when there's more market for it.
I don't think we'll get all of these games, but I think, you know, yes, the industry is changing. Yes, we have seen bets fail. Yes, we have seen shifts in direction. But, you know, we talk so much about how long these games are in development. You know, Sony's going to have games, you know, that are currently in the works, that have been in the works since 2018, you know,
yeah, say,
2019,
so.
2020, like projects from Sucker Punch, projects from Santa Monica. We know they're working on a new IP alongside maybe more God of War stuff. And I think, yeah, things are absolutely getting out the way of Grand Theft Auto 110%, but I don't think it'll be an empty year personally. I mean, we've got GTA, we've got Death Stranding 2 from Sony. I imagine we'll see at least a couple more from Sony for release next year, because I don't think they can go 2 years without any big first party games.
That's probably that might be when you get Tsushima 2 as well.
Yes, I'm thinking maybe Tsushima 2, maybe Santa Monica's new IP, maybe Naughty Dog's. I mean, it'll be 5 years since The Last of Us 2 in 2025. Yeah. So I think the timing for that stuff could be right, but, you know, it could...
We've got Wolverine as
things
well.
We've got Wolverine as well. But like you say, you know, things change, things get delayed. It might end up being empty, but I think at the very least, we'll have a lot of announcements and a lot of things to look forward to, even if that's early 2026 or end of 2026.
I will throw in Jim Donaldson's question, who says, gaming trends do not seem to last as long as typical development cycles. Do you think we're more likely to see smaller games which launch before a trend has ended, or bigger ones which take more risks in the hope of not appearing out of date? This is such a good observation, because Suicide Squad and the Avengers both missed their window considerably. That window was like 10 years ago. I think in regards to the, like, for example, the live service trend, the thing that Destiny set in motion, that in itself was always such a divisive trend anyway. Like, no one ever seemed to enjoy playing those games. Like, people played them, but they were also aware of how much their time was being abused and how grindy the missions were and how naff a lot of that design was. But still, it did take off so much. And then you had all these other publishers go, well, we should do one of them. And then it just took so long to get it over the finish line. I think Suicide Squad, at least I would like to hope, is the end of trying to chase that trend.
You'd hope so, man. I mean, I'd never want to say that out loud almost, because I thought Anthem would have been the end of that trend.
Right.
I thought the Avengers would have been the end of that trend, right? But I guess the reality is...
That is how long Suicide Squad was in development,
that's
though.
That's what I mean. Like, the development is so long that we're seeing games like it come out in 2024 that are just repeating the exact, and I mean the exact same mistakes as games that came out in 2018. Mm-hmm. And I do think that is an issue with development, because, you know, publishers are banking on safe bets, but the safe bets that came out in 2017, 2018 are certainly not the safe bets of 2024. Even something like Gotham Knights, which, you know, I have a lot of appreciation for after playing Suicide Squad and realizing how botched it
how
could
good
have
you
been.
Had it.
Yeah, how good I had it. Like, that was lambasted for, you know, just taking a lot of elements from other games that were now outdated, you know, Assassin's Creed style upgrade trees, and, you know, the loot system based around rarity and just getting the numbers up. And it's like, I do think we'll see more of that, because I wish we didn't, but publishers just seem to be getting more and more scared and banking more and more on trends. So I do think we will start, you know, in another 6 years' time, there will be something that feels incredibly dated that we're talking about that is on this level.
Right now, I am amazed that people are praising Final Fantasy VII Rebirth's open world. That thing feels ancient. That thing feels like what we were sick of when Ubisoft kept doing it. It's like Ubisoft do the same style of open world over and over again, and we all call it out and go, oh my God, you guys guys need to move on. This thing's been outdated for like 5 years. And then like Final Fantasy does it, and we love it for some reason. Like to me, they're the exact same thing, and they're both as like both as tired as each other. But yeah, that whole thing of like the game development outstripping the trend itself is like, that's interesting, because if you think of the 2000s, everyone was doing a Modern Warfare clone. I remember when Hour of Victory dropped, and it was like every Modern Warfare clone that came out had to have some sort of distinguishing thing. And I literally remember standing at a game station holding Hour of Victory, and their whole selling point was that bodies would ragdoll when you throw a grenade.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just remember that being the selling point, and it was like, we've hit the end of this thing. And that was the end of the first person military shooter, like in terms of the copycats. And then it got back down to just being Call of Duty and Battlefield. But yeah, I mean, but back then you could turn a game around in a couple of years, in 3 years or whatever, or less than that, and get in on that trend. Whereas now at a certain production level, you just can't do it.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Battlefield there. The latest rumor about the next game, which according to EA is probably coming out at the end of 2025, is that it's adding a free-to-play Battle Royale mode, kind of like how Call of Duty has added a free-to-play Battle Royale mode with Call of Duty Warzone. And that's a similar question of, you've missed the boat.
Yes.
You know, like that Warzone came out and was at its peak in 2020.
I did an ugh there when you said Battle Royale. Yeah. That's how done I am with that stuff.
I like Battle Royale, but I can still see that as a kind of, you know, it might work, but you've missed, do something else. Like, try to innovate in another way. Like, if that's all you're going to have as a unique selling point 5 years after Warzone, 5 years after your biggest competition has already pulled the trigger to massive success, you need something more. But can you do that in a reality where video game development usually takes at least that 4 or 5 year period to get to completion?
Because with Battlefield, and I'll move on and stuff, but like Battlefield 5 had that Battle Royale mode that was way too late. It was like Firewall or something?
Firestorm.
That was way too late. And then you had them chase Overwatch with Battlefield 2042 with the operators and everything. And then now it's like, okay, what's the competition doing? Let's do this. Like Battlefield has been flailing for so long, and it should have such a strong identity. It used to have such a strong identity. And even in Battlefield 1, was it the operations mode?
That was so cool, I thought.
Flesh that out. Like, you've got signature things that the fan base likes that are appealing to the wider audience, but for whatever reason, I mean, it's a standard, you know, big man at the top says do the thing the competition's doing stuff, which is just so exhausting. We did a whole video on it yesterday, but still, question from Oversoul Gaming, who says, you are both lovely gentlemen, I love listening to you. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My question is, have you ever experienced synesthesia like immersion with your games? A good example would be when wielding a heavy weapon in games, my controller actually feels heavier in my hand.
That's really interesting.
Yeah,
interesting question.
I love synesthesia. I love the idea of different senses crossing over. Like, I love the whole, when you read about people who can like taste purple, or and they hear music differently because they hear certain flavors come to mind, something like that, the crossover of all those things. I think that all that stuff is fascinating. I love psychology and things like, and philosophy and everything. Anyway, I haven't specifically myself, but I included this in case you had. And then, like, crossovers in terms of different feelings. Things will remind me of, it's more nostalgia. Things will remind me of certain smells, certain feelings, certain times of my life when I'm playing certain titles. Like, Night in the Woods is a straight portal back to me being in my town when I was a child.
Yeah.
And it just reminds me of a smaller life, which is very, very comforting. But, like, yeah, I don't know about you.
Yeah, definitely get that sense of sort of place and time. I've never got anything necessarily physically out when playing a standard screen game, and I'll get to VR in a minute because that definitely applies here. Mm-hmm. But I've had that sort of feeling where you've played a game so much that when you step out into the real world, your brain is still thinking about the mechanics of the game or the setup of the game. So you're kind of like looking at real world things and relating to what you would do with them in the video game. Failing to explain it well, because it's a strange feeling, but I got it definitely with GTA 5, where suddenly I was taking everything I was doing in GTA 5, and when I was walking around just town and
just
stuff,
killing people.
No, just being a murderer.
Just stabbing
them. Causing anarchy. No, I was thinking of like parking spots. I don't even drive, but I was imagining driving around these streets and
That's great.
I would do it. And my brain was just wired that way in terms of GTA 5 navigation. And that was strange.
I am at the minute, because I've literally done, my hour count is about 41 hours of Final Fantasy in a week. At the minute, because that game is so cutscene heavy and presentation heavy, and it's got like such a kind of lumbering movement to it if you're not in combat. I have a thing at the minute where, like, when I'm doing anything else, it feels like a Final Fantasy cutscene.
Yeah.
It feels like, well, I'm going to go over here and then I'm going to stand and I'm going to talk and I'm going to turn and I'm going to do this. And that's like a thing that I think you just get if you're immersed in a certain feel of a game for so long. But yeah, the great question though.
Physically, I must admit, I used to get less so now that I've become more accustomed to VR, but especially in the first year or two of playing VR games, my body just did not understand what was going on. Like, I would get out of the headset after playing a game where I have virtual arms that are being tracked by my controllers, and my arms would sort of feel out of sync with my brain, because my brain was so used to my virtual hands that when I was moving my real hands around, they felt virtual. They were the ones that didn't feel real. And that was such a strange but really cool sensation to have.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I kind of got it with similar to what this question suggested, like weight as well. Obviously, I've got the controller in my hand, and my brain is imagining me picking up a bow and arrow or an axe or something.
Mm.
So when I got out, my hands were moving, thinking I had something heavy in them. So I found myself opening doors too quick or, you know, applying too much force for something basic that otherwise would require very little force. Stuff like that occurred a lot. And I kind of miss it now because it was immersive in a way that I've never, ever experienced before in gaming. And I've kind of lost that little bit of boundary meshing in VR now. Now I can't. My brain is just like, that's VR, that's real. But I like the magic of it blending, man.
That's interesting. I remember, I remember when everyone was testing out VR, like in the years before we got proper commercial headsets, like the PSVR and everything else. The testing reports and the initial articles written about that stuff, that's what fascinated me about the idea of people who were playing a first-person shooter. And like one thing was, because you have like two lenses, one for each eye, if they weren't perfectly in sync, that would just completely destroy the person testing because your eyes were looking at completely different things and your brain would be aware of that. But also people playing first-person shooters at the beginning, if they turned like too fast or the game wasn't rendering very well and a weapon or an arm went through a part of the geometry, that apparently made some people feel immediately sick because they knew that that's not how physics work in the real world, but your brain can't tell the difference. And I was like, that's all really fascinating. That idea of tricking your brain and living in like this other world, like it just makes me think of cyberpunk stuff and living in a cocoon and just being fed all the like vitamins and everything.
I remember the first time I played the Resident Evil 7 demo for the PlayStation VR, which is completely separate to the main game. It's just you're sat in a chair, and I think it's Mia from the main game who's kind of running around and tormenting you, essentially.
Yes.
But there's this one bit where she walks right up to you while you're strapped down, and she just stabs you in the gut. And I remember experiencing that for the first time, and I didn't feel pain, but I felt it.
I had the exact same thing.
Like the uncomfortable.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Fullness of it. I felt like something was hitting me there.
It's pure The Matrix where like your mind makes it real.
Absolutely. And I was like, whoa, that is strange. And I was like, Dad, get on this. Have a call that.
Come
and
get stabbed.
And he was like, whoa, that's very strange. You fell off a chair, if I recall. Right. And that was weird. But again, I don't really get that anymore. And I'm like, man, I want that magic back.
That's interesting. Yeah, and we'll move on. But like that happened to me in the PSVR world stuff, which I think was actually from the Sony's London office, who have sadly been shut down now. But that whole thing, there's a bit where you're getting interrogated and a character like betrays another character and stabs you instead, and I felt it in my stomach. I was like, that's really weird.
Yeah,
I don't know whether I like that or not, but still. Question from Brett Murphy, who says, good day, hope you're both doing well. I want to know, what is your dream director and video game pairing for a movie adaptation? Mine would have to be Fede Alvarez and Outlast.
That's a banging shout. That actually rules.
Fede knows horror, and Outlast's short runtime should make it easier to adapt.
Oh, I want that film. Yeah, that sounds amazing.
I've not heard of Fede Alvarez.
He did the Evil Dead remake and Don't Breathe. Can you remember that, with the blind guy who is essentially a bunch of robbers and break into this blind veteran's house, I think he is, and try to rob him blind. Hey. But this guy has got the skills. He's kind of like Daredevil, and he essentially starts murdering them all.
Cool.
It's really good. It's a really good film.
I thought you would know. You know way more movies than I do. My mind just goes to really. True. It Go is. On. My mind just goes to really boring, obvious stuff where I'm just like, I want Jordan Foote Roberts' Metal Gear Solid movie, or I want Gareth Edwards or the Raid dude to do like a Sifu movie or something like that. I'll tell you what, I'll shout out the Sifu promotional movie they made for the game. It came out before the game, and I think it'll still be on PlayStation's official channel. It's a live action mini version of that story.
Yeah.
Not all the way through, but the fight choreography is awesome. If you like the idea of what a live action Sifu movie would look like, go with that. I would love a Sleeping Dogs movie as well, but I don't know who I would give that to, but I love that story. Of just like, it's like Point Break, but like a more Eastern martial arts version of Point Break.
Yeah.
I don't know who you'd give that to, though. I don't know enough sort of Hong Kong action directors off the top of my head.
Well, I love Fede Alvarez for Outlast. I would finance that movie personally if I had money to make that. I want, you know, obviously Dune 2 is out right now.
Yes.
And I really love the work of Denis Villeneuve, the director, like Blade Runner, you know, 2049. I always get that number mixed up with Cyberpunk 2077. But I would love to see him just tackle. I'm trying to think of something suitably epic for him to tackle. Doesn't have to be sci-fi necessarily, but I want something that would translate nicely to that big screen IMAX experience.
There are some Final Fantasies that are more future tech wise. Like, I just thinking through the lens of Blade Runner 2049, I was like, maybe you would do Final Fantasy 13 if you tightened that story up so much.
Yeah.
But the visuals and the scope of it, I was just thinking of Final Fantasy 12 or 13 in terms of the size, because like 12 has all the like the factional warfare Game of Thrones stuff. 13 is like you're up against gods, and it's like, I was just thinking of like a giant scale that's not been done. Like, I like the Final Fantasy Spirits Within movie.
Oh yeah.
But that's not, it's not matching the scale of like those bigger Final Fantasies where you're in those huge cities and like, you know, entire townships like defying physics by like floating in the sky or whatever.
I'd love to see an adaptation of Final Fantasy 16. Maybe not as a film, maybe it's like more of a prestige television show, but I think that world is so fascinating. Some of those 16 characters are so cool. The visuals epic. You know, you've got the big titans in there. I don't know who I'd get to direct it. It's almost an impossible task, but I'd love to see that adapted.
Question from Honest NPC, who says, do you think some games feel better to play at launch, knowing you're playing a game that is trending en masse? I decided not to buy any new titles until later due to a massive backlog, but I can't deny some FOMO over not playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth at launch. I love the launch period. Josh's head is in his hands.
I've got such FOMO right now about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. An incredible amount of FOMO. I was going to get it when I got back from Ireland, but another game dropped in my inbox that I can talk about on a Monday. So I've been playing that instead. And Man, like, seeing everyone talk about a game is next level, right? We always talk about how good it is to be in, to be having those discussions when a new game has dropped that everyone is playing and everyone has thoughts on, and kind of experiencing it together, because you might not be going through it at the exact same rate, but you're both, or everyone is, like, you know, kind of collectively enjoying a thing that is so rare these days, I think, with there being so much choice and media being more fragmented than ever, that, yeah, every time one of those drops, and I do think Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is one of those, I get a little bit of FOMO. I get a little bit of sadness that I can't jump in with it.
Yeah, I love the launch day period. I've long said that reviewing a game sucks. Like, I love the post-launch conversations, like the immediate launch day conversations, that energy. It reminds me of when, like, a sporting event is live, when everyone's watching something at the same time. They're, like, some of the best parts of art and entertainment are communal. And it's as much as it can be fun playing something before everybody else, or it's, like, a unique experience or whatever. From my experience, having now done this over 10 years, like, I just prefer the launch stuff. I would rather not crunch a game into a week period beforehand, as I say that having played 40 hours of Final Fantasy in a week. But still, that whole idea of playing stuff alongside everybody and then getting to have those conversations or whatever is the best.
Yeah,
and it's like, I think that's great. If you're able to afford it and you can get stuck in, it's fun having that. I mean, me and Cyber messaging each other loads, where, like, she's just behind me a little bit on, I forget which location she's at now, but I'll be way ahead because I'm an idiot and I play till about 2 a.m. But we keep messaging each other going, oh my God, have you seen this? What do you think about this? And it's like, I miss that. Like, yeah. We used to have that so much. If you've grown up playing video games, you had that loads in school because everyone was playing stuff. And then it's harder to get that back based on different work locations or how many other people you know who play games.
Yeah, I'm similar to you, man. I think there's probably a shocking amount of early copies and reviews that I've turned down because I've wanted to experience it with everyone else. I've wanted to be part of the hype cycle almost. I've wanted to be there and able to talk about it as I go through it day one, rather than having all of these thoughts and being stuck with them for 2 weeks because I can't talk to anyone about it.
You had that with The Last of Us 2, and I was like, I would have hated to sit on that.
That was a double-edged sword. One, I really loved it because it meant that even though the game was spoiled and there was cutscenes out there, it meant that I could definitively avoid spoilers from people that I knew. But at the same time, yeah, I was playing through it, and it was a lonely experience because there was so much, like, I wanted to talk to you about so much that I wanted your opinion on. Like, just, I wanted to discuss it and I couldn't do it with anyone. It didn't suck. I still really enjoyed my time with it, of course. Still one of the best games ever. Still really proud of that review and stuff. But yeah, man, I must admit, though, there's something to be said about getting to a game late as well.
Yes.
Like, the launch hype is amazing, but I mentioned Adam Nicholas earlier, What Culture Wrestling's Adam Nicholas, who sometimes even live mixes these podcasts. He always gets to games late. Like, he has a thing where he has the self-restraint to wait it out, make sure it is worth his time, and then get to it and experience it on his own terms. He did that with God of War. I think he did it with the original Spider-Man.
Did it with Cyberpunk last year.
Did it with Death Stranding. And then when he came to me to talk about those experiences, I got such a thrill because it meant I got to do those conversations again and maybe see things from a different perspective, because he's had that kind of time away from the hype, from the context in which it released. And I think that's really cool. I mean, I played Baldur's Gate 3 late, and getting to talk about that with you and Adam Strawn was amazing. Like, I didn't feel like I missed anything playing that months after the fact. Than I would during the launch period. So it's like, the FOMO is real, but it's also, I think, a psychological thing, because playing games late also rules.
Well, you get a better version of it. Like, things have been patched out. I wish I'd waited 7 months for Jedi Survivor. It would have been all right. But I always shout out the Patient Gamers Reddit. I don't necessarily go on there too much myself, but there was a whole community dedicated to, like, okay, this game's been fixed. Should I get to this thing later? You are better off waiting if you can. I love the launch day side of things and the immediacy of it, but, like, a lot of that is job-fueled.
Yeah.
If my main thing, like Adam Nicholas or whatever, was working on a different medium altogether, I would relax everything. Although, as I say that, maybe I wouldn't be able to, because I've always done this even before I was hired to do it for a living, so I don't know.
I will say, I think my distinction is I wouldn't jump in anything at launch just because it's the launch. Like, I think I always think you've got to be in the zone. You've got to be really desiring something, at least for me, to the most out of it. Like, I could have played Final Fantasy VII Rebirth now, but maybe I'm not in a Final Fantasy mood, you know? Like, if I'm interested in something, I will always prioritize that over the new thing.
I
won't just play it for the... Not for the sake of it, but I want to make sure I maximize what I'm getting out of it and maximize my interest in it.
I'm the complete opposite. Mainly in Final Fantasy's case, because I'm so close to that and I need to know what they've done with the story. But I was playing Infinite Wealth. I'm like 100 hours into Infinite Wealth. I'm only about 4 or 5 chapters off the end of it, but I was at a point where I got to like Wednesday night and Final Fantasy was releasing at midnight and I knew I wasn't going to be able to finish Infinite Wealth. But I knew days in advance leading up to that I'm about to cleave this game in half and have another 100 hour experience in the middle of it, and then I'll get back to Infinite Wealth. And so it was like, even though I'm loving Infinite Wealth, and part of me was like, I'd love to just see this all the way through.
Yeah.
I knew I couldn't, quote unquote, because I need to go away and play Final Fantasy for a bit. But at the same time, to me, there's a thing about like, if the quality's there, it'll convince you anyway. Like, unless you're actively in a negative mindset of like, well, I don't want to enjoy it, then fine. But I think, I don't know, for me, it's like, if it's worth checking out anyway, that'll come through.
I do, yeah, it's weird. I do agree to a certain extent. Obviously, the quality will come through. You'll be able to recognize something as good, absolutely. I think often about Tears of the Kingdom last year, and that was one that I primarily played because I wanted to have those conversations with you. I wanted to be able to cover it for work. Mm-hmm. It's a huge game, a sequel to one of my favorite games of all time, but I wasn't in a Zelda mood. I wasn't in an open world mood, and I could see that it was good, but I almost sometimes feel like I'm doing myself a disservice and sometimes doing the games a disservice by playing them when I'm not at my peak interest level where I want to be playing something else. I think the worst thing that I can do personally is, not as someone who does this job, just as a fan and a gamer in general, is to play a game while thinking about another game. It's never worth it to me. Play the game that I'm thinking about and then go back to it when I'm ready. You know, I'd never want to have something else in mind or that even minor worry of, am I enjoying this enough or do I really want to be doing something else?
Yeah, I think I have gone back and forth on that like quite a lot over the years, because it is like, well, you should play this for work, or we can do a video on this, or we can do this for the podcast or whatever, and the conversation is always worth it. But sometimes you're just not in the mood, like you said, for another... Like, I played like 80, 100 hours, whatever it is, of Infinite Wealth. Then I've now done another 40 hours in a week of Final Fantasy. I'm fully aware that Rise of the Ronin is out soon, which is another massive game. Dragon's Dogma is after that, which is another massive game. And it's like, all of these in a row is insane. I'm also playing the original Final Fantasy VII on Switch because I want to compare all the scenes and everything. So I'm also doing that. And now, after the Toriyama news, I dug out my old save for Chrono Trigger, and I've got a bit of that on the go. So I'm a sick man, but I like to keep up with the industry kind of thing, because I think that does validate like the majority of my time every day. Like, I want to be able to channel those other hours into something we do for the audience, for the content.
It's funny, we talked about this actually off podcast a few weeks ago, where you were asking me if I was going to get to Helldivers, which is, you know, a game that people are loving. And I was like, you know, I would love to play it. And I'm sure it's absolutely amazing. I'm sure it's a game of the year quality already. But my interest is something like Pacific Drive right now. I'm in a horror mood. I want to play Cannibal Abduction, you know? And I definitely... That's what kind of sways my interest more than kind of what's just the big talking point right now. I always, even though I do this for a job, sometimes I wonder if I'm playing something just because it's a talking point. I'm like, but I'm not doing it for me. I'm not doing it from a place of passion. I'm doing it from a place of curiosity, which can be really rewarding in its own right, but in an era where we've got so many games and so many games are accessible through streaming services or discounts or whatever it is, like there's too many to only prioritize curiosity for me. I've got to prioritize the passion.
I definitely I end up ascribing like a level of duty to it where I'm just sort of like, I'm in this position. I should be able to play everything. I should try and spend my entire wage and all this stuff. And I love doing that. I've done that for so, so long. It's literally only because I'm about to be a dad that I should put the money into something else other than like the games and figures and everything else. But I ascribe that to it where I'm like, I should have knowledge of this. But I think some of that stuff goes into like having to, the way the sections run and like looking after the freelancers and things like that, like being able to have the conversation with what someone wants to cover. I view that as part of like a dutiful thing, but it eats into personal time. Personal time is work time if you start thinking of work as games themselves.
Yeah.
Like I am working 24/7, like if that's the case. But still, like I can't deny that I do want to be part of those conversations. And I think if something like Final Fantasy comes along, I need to know what they've done.
Yes.
And so I'll like, what have you done to my baby? At the minute, they've done a lot to it. And it's all over the place. But yeah, I think it's an interesting conversation, especially for someone or people like us who have done this for so long, because you do need to prioritize yourself. Like you just absolutely need to.
Yeah.
I can't do that right now. It's not if it's with Final Fantasy. Question from Jack Jingle, who says, any big festival memories? I'm heading back to download again this year after meeting my wife at the festival 10 years ago, and we can't wait. Exciting times.
Oh, yes. I've never been download, but I know you have.
Yeah, I think we talked about this, or maybe I did it with someone else who was on the EBP, the idea of like the three festival rule. of like you do three and you're done, whereas you were like, nah, I've done like 30 and I'm fine. Yeah. I very much got a bit tired of doing three in a row. I think it's just because I was getting sick of the camping. I was getting sick of like that stuff, and I liked my time at the seeing the music, but it didn't outweigh the like arduous nature of it. However, I do think that if you just steer into like getting your little finger out and having fun with the hotels and the VIP packages, if you can afford them, or just book a hotel that's nearby, having a deluxe camping experience, I'm all for that now.
Right, okay.
When I was younger, I was like, oh, that's not proper. That's not the real way to do this. And I did enough mud-caked festivals to last me a lifetime, like a handful of downloads. I did like, was it 4 downloads and 2 Sonospheres? I think all in a row. I've never done Leeds or anything.
Oh,
but,
right.
Just because the music's not going to be for me. But like, yeah, after I'd done that many, I was like, I'm good. Like,
right.
I don't need this ever again.
Oh, man. I do get that. You know, when I first started going to Leeds Festival, especially when I've been there a million times now, like the camping was the highlight for me. Just hanging out with my pals in the camping zone, getting up to debauchery and drinking and all of that, and having the crack with the boys. I love that element, but I definitely got to an age where I just couldn't do it anymore. And you know, as we all got older, stopped going to festivals, there was a point where I just kind of had to decide, I still want to go to the festivals, but I'll get a hotel.
Yes, totally.
I'll get a hotel nearby, I'll get the shuttle bus into the site, and I'll get the shuttle bus out, and that'll do me.
Yeah, give me
a
bed.
I don't know how I ever went 5 days without showering at a festival, man. What a stinky boy I was back in those days.
There's such a fun disconnect to just being like, I'm going to leave society for a bit and have this little pocket where like we're all gross, we're all listening to incredible music with people that we love, like either it's friends or it's the musicians or whatever, and just loving that bubble that you're in.
That's what I miss, man. And that admittedly even went away by the end of my camping days at festival. But yeah, initially when you would go in back then in, you know, 2013 or whatever, you didn't have charging ports necessarily, or you couldn't afford charging ports. So I would bring my phone, but I'd have no signal, and I'd have to make sure that battery survived the entire weekend, so I would never turn it on, which meant that no one was on the phones, which meant that no one was getting any news, which meant that when you got back to society after 5 days, you suddenly had everything to catch up on. I remember going back after my first one, maybe, to the news that Ben Affleck was Batman, and it was like a bunch of headlines like that, which was like kind of a hit in and of itself, just catching back up with the world and getting ingrained with the world. But now I love festivals. I am.
Any big specific memoirs?
Oh God, too many to count. I'll try to go through a few quick ones. I've really gotten into day festivals over the past few years. Honestly, I think one of the best festivals I've ever been to was Slam Dunk in 2019.
Slam Dunk is on the rise.
It was incredible. The first day festival I ever did went with my girlfriend and Ash Millman and one of my best friends, Jess. We just had a cracking day. The sun was shining. We had a good laugh together. And it was one of those days as well where it was kind of overwhelming, but in a good way, where I'd never been in a festival context after I got this job. And I met so many lovely people and fans of the channel coming up to me and Ash, who obviously worked here at the time, and like met some cracking people, took some photos. You know, it was just like a good vibe. Like everyone was having a good time. The music was really good. Saw the Menzingers for the first time. Crowd surfed for the first time in my life.
Right.
Ash dropped me on my ass, hurt me back, kind of ruined the day, to be honest. I was walking around afterwards thinking...
She listens to this podcast.
Ah, well, she knows I've chastised her for this plenty of times before. Dropped us on my ass, Scott Taylor. Salford. And I got up and I was like, no, I'm fine. Finished the end of the Menzinger set. And then, you know, when you just like know when something's man. Wrong.
Yeah.
And I was like, my back really hurts and I can't really walk, but I hope it's not going to be too
just do the pensioner
stressful.
Dance.
Yeah, I was like, this could be serious, but I'm too drunk to to think about getting it checked out. And I remember walking back to the hotel in the night thinking, this is going to suck tomorrow. This is going to absolutely suck. But first crowd surfing experience. Nice. And I also want to shout out, if you'll permit me, I went to Outbreak Festival, which is a kind of a hardcore festival in Manchester in 2021, I think. And that was like the best vibe I've ever experienced. Saw some great bands like Drug Church and Turnstile there.
Show.
And I've never really been to a proper hardcore show before because I'm scared. And it was scary because you had to sign a waiver to get.
I was just
saying,
you'll get punched in the head.
Yeah, because you'll get punched in the head. But it turned out that like everyone was lovely. Of course, it had that sort of element to it where, you know, people were going mad, but they were like, I found it very respectful.
Controlled bursts.
That was it.
It's always like, a kind of thing with mosh pits as well.
Sometimes you go to mosh pits for pop punk shows, right? And they can have bad crowds because there's no kind of etiquette there. There's just a sort of vibe of, well, I'm going to mosh and like, if you get hit, I don't care. We're not picking anyone up.
Yeah.
Screw you. This is my night.
Right.
At least in this Outbreak Festival, there was like, obviously a lot of that, a lot of pushing, shoving, you know, stuff. But there was a understanding that like, if you fall down, you get picked up. If you don't want to be involved, you're not involved. Don't worry. We're not going to like make you get involved. It's like, there's
that's
a sort of barrier.
Is.
And I was like, that absolutely rules. Mm-hmm. I love that. Everyone was getting up on the stage, you know, dancing, jumping, singing the songs. I got kicked in the head a few times listening to, trying to get on the stage myself for Drug Church. Turnstile put on an absolute belter of a show. It was class. I'm going to go back this year as well because it was just amazing.
I feel like Slam Dunk's on the rise. Like I feel like a lot of, nearly every single human I knew was at Slam Dunk last year.
Yeah.
Maybe the year before as well. As opposed to Download, which used to be like the big name in like metal circles, and it kind of still is, but I feel like Slam Dunk was getting a lot of good names in a way that Download hasn't had the buzz in a while.
Yeah, I think Slam Dunk isn't even necessarily my music. Like there's always a couple of bands that I go there to see, but... you know, like the sort of the pop punk stuff I'm not necessarily as into now as I was when I was a teenager. So there's a lot of nostalgia acts that I wouldn't mind seeing, but it's not necessarily my vibe. But it's just a nice day out. It's like a nice location. It's good to be with your pals, just kind of like experiencing some new music. I want to ask you though,
yes.
Who is the best act that you've ever seen at a festival?
Mine's, I think we talked about this one on a previous UBP, maybe it was a wind up or something. Cause the most historic thing that I was just glad to be part of that felt incredible. Actually, I guess I've got two. One was the Big Four at Sonos Field, which I've mentioned before. It was the first time Metallica, Megadeth, Slayer, and Anthrax all played together, and Dave Mustaine came back out, singer of Megadeth, having previously been the guitarist for Metallica and played with them for the first time in like 30 years, and it was phenomenal. Also, seeing Black Sabbath live in like 2013, when Tony Iommi, the guitarist, had been diagnosed with cancer and no one really knew if he was going to be there. And then obviously it would have been planned, but it hadn't leaked or whatever. When he finally walked back out on stage and he was all right and they got to play those songs and they just had the new album that year as well. And then Ozzy Osbourne was like surprisingly incredible.
Nice.
He had to keep going off to the side and taking gas and air, but he was nailing all the songs. He was jumping around, he's having fun. That was historic. And I think they toured after that, but it's like, I'd never seen Sabbath before.
Yeah.
And they were huge. Like that was a Download 2013. Or maybe the year before, but it was that era. The biggest thing for me was definitely the Big Four, because I just felt like I am witnessing history. I remember buying the box set of that so I could like try and look for myself in the crowd.
Oh,
and
that's
stuff,
so cool.
And
man.
Be like, that was a big deal like for metal. And there's like smaller stuff like seeing Cancer Bats in a tent. Like I'm remembering talking about this, so maybe I've already talked about it. Apologies if I've repeated it. But there was a whole set where Cancer Bats gear got stolen on the Saturday. And they had to cancel their slot, and they rescheduled for like later that night. I forget what year this would have been, maybe 2014 or 15. And they ended up just playing this little tent, and it was like, it was right after, I forget the name of the album, but it has Old Blood on it, which is like the sickest song they've ever done. I love Old Blood. It's like this anarchic, ridiculous, over the top hardcore song. And they just played in this tent, and it was like only the fans were there because it was like this bonus gig. And it was just so sweaty and messy and perfect.
Nice.
And yeah, man, it was great. And I'd only just met my now wife a couple of years prior to that anyway, so it was one of our first times at Download, and it was just incredible. So I think young love at Download, young love at festivals is a nice sign.
Hey, the first time I ever went to a festival, it was similar to you. It was
right.
The first time I was well, a couple of months after I got with my girlfriend, so we managed to experience every festival after that together. It was very good. Aww. Young Lovett festivals to old Lovett festivals. What a good pipeline that is.
All the way through. Question from Tarnished Yas, who says, do you know how certain movies have a Sunday afternoon vibe? Are there any games that give you the same feeling? I remember playing Oxenfree, Firewatch, Gone Home, and What Remains of Edith Finch one Sunday, and they felt just right. Thanks for the awesome pod. Well, thank you for listening.
Thank you everybody. Very much. I love the idea of a Sunday movie. Yeah. Ewan's a big fan of the Sunday movie. But in terms of the Sunday game,
yes,
I don't know if there is, you know.
Really?
I don't think I've ever like kind of sat down and thought this is a Sunday game. Maybe sometimes when I play multiplayer stuff, if I just kind of want to spend a Sunday doing that. But in terms of vibes, no, I don't know. But I'm interested if you have one.
I don't have a, mine's just whatever I'm playing on that day. But like nine times out, because I work Saturdays and I nearly always see my parents on a Sunday. So it's rare that I have like a whole day on a weekend. So like for me, if I have a full clean slate, I'm a coffee man. I'll brew. I have a 500 mil mug.
Amazing.
It's a huge mug, like what they have in Friends. And I'll do a specific, really intense brew through the cafetiere. I'll make a nice big brew with a whole ton of thick milk, and I'll sit with that. And that's my day.
Oh,
just a nice big brew with like some really thick tiger bread. I was talking. Shout out to Dan Durkin's Pixels and Perspectives podcast, but I guested on that the other day, and I was talking about how centering just a nice bit of bread with some toast and jam on is.
Oh yeah, man.
And I was like, just I love it.
Yeah, maybe not the jam. But definitely the toast.
Are you not a jam fan?
I'm not a jam fan.
What are you talking about?
I know I hate the British band The Jam. I've never been a big jam guy myself. But I'm a big toast guy.
When was the last time you had jam?
You know what, right? When I got my first like proper flat and I got this job for the first time, I thought I'm gonna sort my life out.
It's 10 years ago then.
Yeah, felt like a long time ago. I think it was maybe 7 years ago.
A little bit, yeah.
I decided to get into jam because I thought people who like jam have their lives together.
And
I remember trying it for the first time thinking, you guys are off your heads. Why do you eat this stuff? But toast, how, bread, amazing.
But you like, I can't
miss this. We have to wrap it up.
I said, look, you've had a big week. I think you should compliment changing countries by trying a bit of jam again. Maybe you'll like it.
But butter is so good, right?
Butter is
incredible. Why would I want to replace it with any other condiment?
It's not replacing, is it? It's additive. It goes with it. You put the strawberry jam. My point was that I love a nice big brew and a nice big thick bit of bread with some jam on, and that centers me, and I just love jam. I feel like if all the world leaders just took a minute to have a bit of tea and toast, I think they'd probably be all right. Like
I think so, but I think if they put jam on that toast, like it would start wars. Like someone would be like, "What the hell is this?"
Yeah, Putin arrives with the jam, and everyone else leaves the room.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sick of him. But I think that whole thing, that's what makes a Sunday vibe to me. It's being able to free up the time to just be able to do a slow brew, and I know I don't need to be anywhere, and I can just sit with whatever game. If I'm going to narrow it down, it is RPGs, specifically JRPGs, Final Fantasies, like old school Final Fantasies. If I'm replaying like 7, 8, 9, like the original ones, dedicating a day, a few hours to that is bliss.
Yeah, man. For me, I guess it would be the closest thing I get to it is open world games, and it's not doing any story stuff. It's getting up in the morning, like you mentioned, getting a brew, getting some breakfast, and just kind of mopping up some side missions or having an explore, something that is low stakes.
Side missions with a podcast on.
Sack the podcast off, but yes, I agree.
Someone tagged me in a meme. Shout out to this person. I'm sorry, I don't know what your name is off the top of my head. Showing like a two-stage meme of like someone going like, great day to like watch like a bunch of stuff, watch a movie, watch whatever, whilst I text my friend and get distracted doing five things at once. And I was like, that's not what I'm doing. I just like to have two things on. I like to have a bit of audio with a game. I'm not texting with a movie on.
He's laughing. I told you I met with my mate Matt in Ireland, who's met you before, obviously, and has always great things to say about you.
Good man.
Because you are amazing.
Shout out to Matt, thank you.
But he was also laughing again at your madness of having all of these screens and having all of these activities occurring at the same time.
People are assuming it's like that scene in Swordfish or like every 90s hacker movie where it's like 50 screens. I'm like, no, it's a TV and a laptop next to me and that's it.
Sometimes I swear down you do this just to piss me off, right? we'll be messaging each other, and you'll be like, Josh, I've got this game on, right? And you'll send me a picture from your couch that's an image of the telly with the game, and you always make sure to include the laptop with, like, Spotify or something on. Yep. It ruins me day every time, like a podcast on YouTube. And I'm like, oh, he's done that to just batter
me
in the ribs.
That is specific framing. If I had two phones, I would have my phone as another screen in front of her as well. Just have as many data streams as possible. But it's got to be done.
Oh, I don't know about that, but I'll buy it. Whatever makes you happy on your Sunday, man.
Yeah, you're going to have a nice time. Speaking of a nice time, this is the Entitled Banter podcast, the EBP, the UBP.
The UBP.
I've been Scott Taylor, that's been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Taylor. Thanks for having me on again.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you. Thank you all very much for your questions. Have a lovely weekend. We'll catch you next week.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.